This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
The Humana Honor Medicare Advantage Plan gives you $1,860 back each year in your Social Security check. Choose coverage that helps you keep more money in your pocket. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. The Part B Give Back benefit pays part or all of your Part B premium, and the amount may change based on the amount you pay for Part B. Limitations and restrictions may apply. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Sports Illustrated NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast. Glad you could join me this week. And I would like to use this week to introduce a guy that is going to be on the podcast regularly with me. He is a writer over at Sports Illustrated, SI.com. You can read him there. Rohan Ned Carney. What's up, Rohan? How you doing, man?
I'm great, Chris. How are you?
Glad you could be part of this little venture with me.
No, it's an honor for you to have me on. I've always wanted to do a boxing podcast, so I'm really excited about it.
Oh, we're doing boxing.
Okay. Oh.
No, that's later in the week.
I see. Okay.
That's later. Are you becoming a boxing aficionado? Is there something I should know about your, changing sports? Is that you coming over to this side?
You know, it can't hurt in the 21st century media landscape, video, boxing. You got to have a lot of weird things on the resume. So I respect you doing it. I've tried to be like you for years, so
aim higher, aim way higher than me. I just decided to diversify at 22 because I couldn't do anything all that well. I was like, I can do five things mediocre. That's probably better for me than doing one thing above average. So
that's my life mantra. So
yeah,
I'm with you
there. All right. Well, a lot to get to this week. I want to start in the Western Conference too. As we speak, the team at the top of the Western Conference is the LA Clippers. The Clips are a top 10 offensive team, which is not unusual for them. They have the number one bench in the NBA, which is unusual. It's led by Lou Williams. You got Montrezl Harrell there. Lou Williams, once again, one of the league's top sixth men. I got to see them in Washington this past week. They didn't win that game. They're coming off a back-to-back. Didn't get into D.C. till 3 o'clock in the morning. But, they're impressive, Rohan. There's not the star power, obviously, that there once was. But they're winning with depth, and they're winning with, quality B-plus level talent, and that seems to be enough, at least early in the season. What do you make of what you see in the Clippers?
It's interesting. I don't want to be the guy who rains on the parade. I do wonder what the ceiling for that team is. Like, I think right now what we're seeing is a team that's built for the regular season, right? They can withstand injuries. You mentioned the bench. They can play, 8-9 deep, whatever it is. That is a great recipe for success during the regular season. It helps that they have those tone setter guys and Pat Beverly, you mentioned Harrell, Avery Bradley. They really get after people every night. In that sense, they kind of remind me of those early 2010s Bulls teams. Obviously, they still had some star power in Derrick Rose, but this is the kind of team that's just annoying to play every single night in the regular season, and they keep coming at you. I think they're great. I mean, obviously, I don't think either of us think they're the best team in the West. I also wouldn't be shocked, though, if they lost their first-round playoff series. You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah, no, I do, because they don't have that one alpha that end-of-game situations or can just take over games at any point. A few things that impress me, and I'm also not sure if it's sustainable. Their rebounding has been passable. It's not great by any stretch, but they're right there in the middle of the pack in terms of overall rebounding percentage, and that's something that worried the Clippers coaching staff coming into the season. Would they have enough size to rebound? With the depth, is it going to hold up? I mean, Montrezl Harrell, to me, is a lock right now for most improved player. I mean, I know there are a lot of candidates. Derrick Rose is on that list. JaVale McGee is on that list. You can go down the line. But Montrezl Harrell, out of nowhere, is one of the better bench players in the NBA. Is he going to be able to keep that up over the course of a season? And look, they're starting a rookie point guard. You know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is a lot better than I thought he was going to be coming into the season. I thought he was drafted largely because of what he looked like in terms of his NBA body. He's got that kind of Rajon Rondo wingspan to him. I wasn't all that impressed when I watched him play at Kentucky, but he looks like an NBA point guard. But can that be sustainable over the course of an 82-game season with a rookie playmaker there? There are a lot of questions with this team in terms of how they sustain this over the rest of the next few months.
Yeah, I mean, just to add in a couple of things, you mentioned Harrell. I really loved him when he was on the Rockets. I remember there was that stretch. Clint Capella was hurt. Harrell was starting. He had multiple 20-point games, multiple big rebound games. I think I actually wrote a small thing for SI about him then. I've always really liked his game. I mean, he makes a lot of sense. He's not the best defender, but in terms of a rim-running center, he's always made a lot of sense to me. In terms of star talent, Tobias Harris can kind of be that guy on some nights. At some point, we have to discuss the Lee Jenkins effect, what it's like that, you know, he's been there. All of a sudden, they go on this big run. But in all seriousness, Doc Rivers, too, since last year, I mean, this team maybe would have made the playoffs last year if they didn't get some injuries down the stretch of the season. Beverly missed most of the year. Rivers, ever since they've, you know, to put it nicely, let him focus on coaching, has been doing a much better job.
Yeah, Tobias Harris, career numbers across the board, including scoring, field goal percentage. He's up to about 42% from three-point range. I mean, he's an all-star, at least if you are making out all-star lists right now. So he's been great. You know, the other part of this too, Rowan, is, you know, the Clippers, they deep down, they know they're not a championship team. But there's got to be an upside to being really good going into the summer of 2019. We all know their free agent situation. We all know who their targets are. They're the top tier guys. You know, Kevin Durant, Kawhi Leonard. And, you know, they have, whether it's Lawrence Frank, the GM, or other members of their front office, part of their plan for free agency is basically to have a presence at Raptors games and at Warriors games all season long, to have, you know, Kawhi and Durant know that the Clippers are there, you know, kind of looking at them. So being good, I think, can only help their chances of luring one of those top tier guys, because those top tier guys would know they're not just going to a team that is, you know, out on the outside of the playoffs looking in. They could be going to a team that could be a middle of the pack playoff team that they could make into a true title contender.
Without a doubt. It's so interesting to me, because I think you can kind of look at it both ways in terms of what LeBron did this last summer, joining a Lakers team that I think a lot of people are still scratching their heads about in terms of why did he really do this? What's the real story here? And now with the Clippers, it's like, hey, not only do we offer you that Los Angeles appeal that you guys seem to love, like, this is a really good team. I mean, you add a star to that team, they have the role players that you need on a championship team. You know, Tobias Harris is a great second or third guy if you have a Kevin Durant already. So I agree. I think it makes a lot of sense that superstars are going to give them a long look in the summer. Being good will certainly only help them moving forward.
Yeah, they're a legitimate alternative to the Lakers, and maybe even better if you're a star player that doesn't want to team up with LeBron, that wants to compete with LeBron as you chase championships.
Already better. Just throwing that out there. They are already better, technically. So
I mean, just a better alternative. Mm-hmm. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, it's, yeah. You know, the Lakers are still the Lakers. And some people across the league want to play with LeBron. I do think people overestimate the lure of playing with LeBron James from the top tier guys. It's not that Durant doesn't respect him. It's not that Kawhi doesn't respect him. But the sense I get from talking to agents and other executives is that, you know, guys in Durant's position, where he's probably going to have three championships, he's probably not going to want to go help LeBron win championships. He's going to go somewhere that he can compete with LeBron for championships. I've said this here on the podcast before. You know, there's a competition right now for who is the Michael Jordan of this era, for who is the Kobe Bryant of this era, who is the guy that's going to collect the most rings, Tim Duncan of this era, who's the guy that's going to collect the most rings. And if you join up with LeBron James, you're not competing with him, are you? You're basically going to be limited to the same number of championships that he's getting.
Certainly, yeah. There's a lot of elements that come to playing with LeBron. There's kind of no one wants to be in that Kevin Love role either. No one wants to be the scapegoat. That's going to be its own interesting storyline, I think, moving forward throughout his career, which guys end up actually playing with him.
Hey, Kevin Love. Kevin Love's had a very nice run. Kevin Love's at the end of this contract. Kevin Love's going to have made $250 million. He's going to have a championship. He's going to have a ton of all-star appearances. Kevin Love's going to have a Hall of Fame career and all the money that goes with it. I understand what you're saying. Well, Kevin Love being kind of the whipping boy on those LeBron teams, but Kevin Love made out okay.
He did all right. He was in the fire there for a couple of years, though.
He was. All right. To a team the Clippers played last week and lost to last week, the Washington Wizards, they got a big win this week, knocking off Houston despite 50-plus from James Harden. Rohan, they're now 3-1 since reports of that practice infighting were made public. The question I have with Washington is, are they still a team to you that's ripe for an overhaul? Are they a team that is more likely than not to be dismantled before the start of the season or the end of the season? Or do you keep this group together? Do you try to build on some of this momentum from the past week and try to make a run with a team that frankly has had a pretty short ceiling over the last 5-6 years?
Honestly, I thought they should have blown it up in the summer. And here's why. You mentioned the short ceiling. I don't think the Otto Porter contract was a mistake. I think he's a really, really good player. The problem they have is they've seen that core maxed out. And if you're paying Otto Porter as your third guy, you know, however many millions, 25 million plus, that's just not a core that's good enough. I mean, we already have them behind the Bucks, the Raptors, the Celtics, the Sixers. What are they going to do with this current team? Like, if they keep it together, do you see them beating any of those other four, you know, in a playoff series? I don't. So I've kind of held the belief that they should break it up. Maybe Phoenix gets desperate for someone like John Wall, but I do try to hold on to Beal. I think Beal is a really, really good player and someone who can be part of their future. It's tough because you can't exactly package Wall's contract as big as it is with someone else. But my biggest issue with them is, you know, in this era of guys teaming up, your third highest paid guy just isn't a superstar. And that's not a knock on Otto Porter, who's a great player. He's just not in that category. And that already kind of puts a ceiling on where they can go. So I kind of do think they need a big overhaul there.
Okay. That you twice called Otto Porter a great player there. what are you doing?
I'm trying, you know, it's my first time doing this. I'm not trying to make an enemy right at the gate. I plan on making some more enemies later, so I'm saving it for later in the podcast. But right now, I'm not trying to go after Otto Porter.
Otto Porter is part of the problem in D.C., and that contract was a mistake. They should, just like the Portland Trailblazers should have let the Nets take Allen Crabbe, Washington Wizards should have let the Nets take Otto Porter. In fact, maybe you do what the Blazers did and revisit that and see if the Nets want to take on Otto Porter in that contract. I mean, he's a good player, a serviceable player, seemed at the time of the deal to be a guy that fits in pretty well alongside John Wall and Bradley Beal. But he's a big part of the problem this season. His numbers have not been very good this year. And if you're making $26 million per year, John Wall's going to make a lot of money next year, but Otto Porter's making a lot of money right now. He's making $26 million this year. If you're making that much money, you've got to be better than 11, 12 points per game. I'll get to my take on whether the Wizards should break it up in a second, but there's a lot of attention paid to John Wall, and John Wall deserves the attention. He's the franchise player. He's underperformed. His team is underachieved. He's due about $160 million over the next 4 years in an absurd contract. He deserves criticism. Same thing with Bradley Beal. They are the alphas on that team. But the biggest reason that this team as a whole, to me anyway, has underachieved this year has been Otto Porter hasn't gotten it done. Markieff Morris hasn't gotten it done. Austin Rivers hasn't gotten it done. The supporting cast around John Wall and Bradley Beal has as much to do with why the Wizards are where they are as John Wall and Bradley Beal.
Well, I want to push back on that a little bit because how much of that comes from, you know, the star guys kind of setting the tone? I've always looked at the Blazers as kind of the bizarro version of the Wizards, right? Like two young guards and what's going to happen with them. And they gave out these big contracts. But you see guys like Dame and CJ, they improve every year. They add different things to their game every year. They've improved as leaders over the course of their career. you know, last year the Blazers had a top six defense. That was always the knock on them. You can't build a good defense around Dame. They've cleared up those aspects of their game. Whereas Wall, I think he's had this position now for a long time where he's annoyed that people are doubting him, but he hasn't done anything to prove differently. And I just think that kind of has an effect on the role guys. What's frustrating to me about the Wizards is, in a sense, they kind of look right on paper. You know, they have the quote-unquote pick-and-roll center in Dwight Howard. They have the 3-and-D guys in Otto Porter and Markieff Morris. They can play small. They can play big. What frustrates me is, I don't know, I do agree Otto Porter's been disappointing. Austin Rivers has been disappointing. But I think it starts at the top, and I just think that the top guys that are setting such a bad tone that it's having an effect on everyone else on the roster.
I mean, regardless of a difference of opinion that we might have here, I still think you break it up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if everything goes, even if they correct things and they meet their own expectations, what's the ceiling for a team like this? We know what it is based on what we've seen in the last 5 years. It's a second round team that, you know, maybe can show some fight. Maybe they can get to a conference finals, but this is not a championship team. And because they've doled out so much money in long-term contracts over the last few years, they're kind of landlocked with this roster. They've got a hit on some of those second-round picks or late first-round picks, and some of them they have. I mean, Thomas Satoransky can play. Like, mm-hmm. he is a good player that they got at a reasonable pick. But it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to be wed to this type of roster. Now, I would be very nervous about the current front office in Washington making a Bradley Beal trade. Bradley Beal is the best asset they have by a mile. Bradley Beal is infinitely more valuable on the trade market than John Wall. If the trade market for John Wall is like three teams, the trade market for Bradley Beal is 30. I mean, everybody is going to be interested in Bradley Beal. So do you want the front office that has kind of put this team in the position they're in? Ernie Grunfeld, Rohan, has been there 16 years. 16 years without winning a championship. I mean, I like Ernie, but 16 years without winning kind of says something, doesn't it? I mean, do you really want them making a significant move like trading Bradley Beal?
I mean, it's tough. You kind of saw that situation play out with Stan Van Gundy to an extent in Detroit, where if someone's on their way out, you don't want them making moves because they're kind of in cover your ass mode, right? You know, they're going to make the moves that are going to help them the most in the short term. And Grunfeld, again, has been the kind of guy who, you know, Sharp touched on this in a column recently he wrote for SI, but they keep Grunfeld kind of in limbo. They don't give him long-term security, but then they ask him to make these moves. My biggest fear is that somehow the Wizards are going to end up keeping John Wall and trading Bradley Beal. That's something that I'm really nervous about, because I don't know who takes that Wall contract. Phoenix is honestly the only team I can think of that would.
Yeah, that's because everybody thinks Robert Sarver's an idiot, and they're right. Like, they, you know, Robert Sarver is impatient. He is meddlesome. He wants to put together a winning team right away. And you can, in a theoretical way, you can understand why a John Wall, Devin Booker backcourt with DeAndre Ayton in the front court mm-hmm. would be appealing. But if you do that, you are committing, as I said, $40 million a year over the next 4 years to a player who has a history of knee injuries. And I don't know if you're Phoenix, if you want to put yourself in that type of position. The only other team I would think of is Miami, because Miami is just nuts. Like, Miami, whether it's Pat Riley, you know, the desperate need to win in the twilight of his executive career, they're just willing to take on anyone and anything in terms of contracts. I don't think John Wall's contract scares them one bit. In fact, I think they're so confident, and justifiably so, that if you put John Wall in their program, in the same way that Dion Waiters thrived in their program, and so many others have thrived in their program, if you put John Wall in that program, they can improve him. They can extract more out of him, and they can make him, once again, a top 5-10 level point guard in this league.
Yeah, it's going to have to be a team that's either stuck in cap hell like Miami, or a team that is convinced it's not going to get a big free agent otherwise, which is why, you know, someone like Phoenix comes to mind. It's going to be so interesting, because we can sit here and say they got to blow it up, and I think most people would agree. Most people around the league probably agree. I don't know how they can get good value back on guys like Porter and on guys like Wall, just because I mean, their value's got to be the lowest it's been at any point in their careers. I mean, Beal's their only valuable asset, but do you even want to part with him right now? I'm really, really curious how that situation's going to go, because I don't see a kind of a good path forward for them. I think it's going to be painful for quite a few years.
Let me tell you what I would do, and I want to get your take on this. I would make NFL-style transactions with Wall and with Porter. I would give John Wall away for a second-round draft pick or low-level cap filler to make the numbers work. I would give Otto Porter away for the same type of deal. I wouldn't even be concerned with what I got back in return. I would start to rebuild this thing around Bradley Beal. I would clear my books to give me some flexibility, and I would use, you know, I would be judicious with their caps. Remember, Washington is as much a victim of the summer of 2016 as anybody. I mean, the spending they did, Jan Mahimi is virtually unplayable on that team, like virtually unplayable. The spending they did that summer has had a catastrophic impact on their books. So I would start to, you have an asset that, you like you say, people don't want to give much back for Wall or Porter. Say, fine, don't give me much back. Here's John Wall. You just have to absorb that contract. Here's Otto Porter. You just have to absorb that contract. I know it's a tough pill to swallow given the talent level of those players and the age of those players, but this is a team at a crossroads. You know, again, even if things go right, Rohan, they're not a championship-level team, and these guys are just going to get a year older and a year less desirable.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think their ceiling this year at best is the fifth-best team in the East, probably not even making it to the conference finals. I actually kind of agree with you on the trade stuff. I mean, I remember over the summer, I was just running through stuff. I was like, if they can get rid of Otto Porter for an expiring contract, it doesn't really matter who that guy is. They should do it. And I'm kind of with you on that with Wall also. If they can get expiring contracts.
But he said Otto Porter's a great player. He's a great player, man.
Listen.
Come on, great player.
I know you do the morning shows and stuff.
Give him away.
And
you got give him away.
You got a lot of excitement and energy, but I try to take a more measured approach.
That's not a measured approach. You call the guy a great player. That's not measured. That's just extreme positive.
Listen, he shoots a lot of threes in NBA 2K, man. He's like unstoppable in that game. I don't, you know, that counts to me for something. Maybe not for you. I get that. But still, listen, I do think Otto Porter this year, I don't judge him just on this year. I think he's I'll scale back from great to very good. I think he's a very good player, and in the right situation, he can be incredibly useful. Washington is just not the right situation for him. He's run out of utility with his current team. Right now, his best value for them is to get that expiring deal, is to find a way to rebuild this team because they've hit their ceiling, if that makes sense.
His three-point shooting in 2016-17, 43.5%. Last season, 44%. This season, you want to guess?
I'm going to go 29.
No, I mean, that's even lower than it is.
Okay.
35.6%. So he dropped about 9 points.
Okay, you know, a small sample size. Maybe he'll bounce back.
We're at the quarter point of the season. It's not that small a sample size, right? It's pretty, big.
Does that mean we can agree the Celtics are trash since it's a quarter way through the season? And
I think that's a slightly different. I'm going to give you a chance. I get Brian Scalabrine coming on later, but I'm going to give you a chance at the end to get your digs in.
The
Boston Celtics. All right, but let's move on to another mess in Philadelphia. Markelle Fultz has visited with doctors in New York City this week. He's going to get a couple of opinions, figure out what's going on with that shoulder. There is a difference of opinion amongst team Markelle Fultz's people and people in the Sixers organization about exactly what is wrong with him. Clearly, Markelle Fultz and his team believe there's something physically wrong. If you ask people in Philadelphia, Rowan, and I've done this with a couple, it's more mental than it is physical with Markelle Fultz. What do you make of the latest development of as Markelle Fultz turns?
Well, it's always seemed mental to me, frankly. The physical thing never really quite checked out. And there's all these insane stories out there about he was gotten a motorcycle accident or got bit by a shark or something stupid. First of all, it's crazy to me when I heard that first report that Markelle Fultz wants out of Philly. And I'm like, what more can they do for you, man? Like, they gifted you a starting spot. They drafted you number one. For him to want out of Philly is insane to me. It's like, I don't know where he's going to go, where he's going to get the same kind of coddling that he's gotten with the Sixers so far. It's one of the more just insane NBA stories the last couple of years. This guy, from all appearances, just got the yips. and forgot how to shoot. I see, guys like Miami media saying, oh, we should take a flyer on Markelle Fultz, all these teams. I think you got to stay away from that guy. I mean, it's not as simple as someone like John Wall, who was just a bad shooter his rookie year and then eventually became a little bit better at shooting threes or whatever. This guy has some kind of issue that no one seems to be able to diagnose. I think he's like the biggest red flag in the league right now. You got to stay away. If Philly can move on, I think the sooner the better. The fact that they maybe weren't including him in something like a Kawhi trade over the summer was always mind-boggling to me. I mean, they got to cut bait with this guy, because what are you gaining by keeping him on the roster at this point? He's either taking away playing time, from guys who need it, like Ben Simmons or Jimmy Butler, or he's just creating this cloud. I think he's a huge stay away.
Yeah, look, to rewind the clock on this a little bit, and it's not the current front office. Brian Colangelo was in charge at that time. I don't think they did enough homework on Markelle Fultz and to prepare for this. When Markelle Fultz worked out for Boston, he did not shoot the ball well. And there were red flags in that workout that made the Celtics run away from him and made the Celtics eager to make that deal that turned out great for them. They got Jason Tatum and a future first-round pick. It's been all roses for Boston. I'm not sure how Boston saw that and Philadelphia didn't. You remember they had that very publicized workout where Fultz flew in to Philly, worked out with Embiid and those guys. And from what I gather, that wasn't a traditional shooting drill, kind of really lock in on a guy's form type of workout. It was more like, how does he fit playing with some of these guys? And they like what they saw out of him. I think they could have done their due diligence there. I agree with you, and I agree with people within the Sixers, that this is far more mental at this point than it is physical. He's doing all sorts of weird stuff out there. I mean, the double tap with the ball at the free throw line.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, that's a mental thing. Like, that is, it's kind of akin to what DeAndre Jordan is doing right now in Dallas. I was in Dallas this past weekend. Jordan, who is like an almost 80% free throw shooter right now after being 58% last year, when he gets to the line, he's changed his form, he's changed his footwork, he puts more arc on the shot, but right before he shoots, he starts yelling at some of his teammates that are on the line. He might look at one of his teammates on the bench and yell something at them. He just yells because it takes his mind off the free throw. So he yells, steps up, and shoots. That, to me, what Markelle Fultz was doing with that tap move at the free throw line was trying to get his mind off the shot itself. And I don't know how you get past that. I'd like to think that you can. I'm rooting for Markelle Fultz. He seems like a good kid, and he was a great player for 1 year at Washington, but he's in a tough spot with this Sixers organization because the Sixers don't have time to rehabilitate Markelle Fultz. They are trying to win something right now. That's why they send him to the bench, and that's why they're rolling with TJ McConnell in the second half or fourth quarter in those backup minutes instead of Markelle Fultz. I wrote this last week, Rowan, and I still believe it. You got to send him to the G League. You have to send him down. The only way this guy is going to get better is if he's playing in a low-pressure environment, he's playing 35, 40 minutes a game, and he can just work out these problems outside of the spotlight. And that can't happen in Philadelphia. You can talk about the value of practices and being around NBA coaches, but that value, I think, is overshadowed by the need that he has to be in a low-pressure situation and just playing basketball without everyone looking over his shoulder.
I agree. I think the G League idea is a great idea. He needs that. He just needs reps. Like, that's what it feels like. It feels like he needs reps. And like you mentioned, the low pressure is so key. I mean, you can't have someone like him in his position learn on the fly starting, in an NBA game. And it's got to be humiliating for him. Guys just don't guard him. I mean, it's not like Ben Simmons when you're dropping. It's like guys are just ignoring him when he's on the floor offensively. Something that is just so remarkable to me about Philly, and it comes down to really how you feel about Jimmy Butler. But I remember Brett Brown after that, playoff exit, or it might have even been after they beat the Heat in the first round, and he just kind of listed every asset the organization has. He says, we got a pick coming back, we have these draft picks, we have this cap space, and we know what we have to do. And how quickly it's changed over the course of a summer for Philly. They're certainly not in a bad spot, but compared to kind of the promise and the hope that they had a couple months ago, they're now tied to Jimmy Butler. Fultz is a complete unknown. Simmons is not as exciting as he was down the stretch of last season. That to me is such a fascinating situation. And Fultz, I mean, I just can't think of anything like it. I don't know if they could, the G League, or if they can find someone to trade him at this point. Like you said, they can't afford to wait. Like, they need guys, they need depth. They're missing the shooting that they had last year. They can't afford to wait on Fultz. Like, they need someone to help them. I'm very curious how that's going to play out for them.
I'd be cautious if I were them about going after trades right now, because the value, it's pretty low. I don't think it's rock bottom low, but it's pretty low at this point. I mean, I put in my column that, you know, I had one executive say Philadelphia should call Phoenix about a Trevor Ariza deal. And I kind of laughed at that. I'm like, you're really going to trade, you know, the number one pick a year ago for a 33-year-old fading forward who's on a one-year contract? That doesn't make any sense. But I was surprised at, like, the Philly fans and the social media reaction I got on Twitter. It was like, oh, I'd take Trevor Ariza tomorrow. Deal him. Get him out of here. Like, let's move. Like, I don't think you can do that with a guy that clearly has high-level talent and is under your control for the next 2.5 years. I mean, Markelle Fultz really can't go anywhere until, like, 2021. And that's, I think, if the Sixers at that point decide not to extend him a qualifying offer. So they've got full control over him for, you know, again, at least the next 2.5 seasons. I think you got to try to spend at least the next year playing this out and figuring out what you do with him. I would not trade Markelle Fultz this season.
The G League idea is not a bad idea. I will say that does seem like a good middle ground. Stop trotting him out there during NBA games. Don't give up on him just yet. The G League seems like a very good middle ground.
Yeah. All right. So this is another weird story that I want to move on to. The San Antonio Spurs rolling along, you know, without Kawhi Leonard out there. And I think it's everyone can say that DeMar DeRozan has been a really good fit with that team. And he stepped in and played good basketball. Greg Popovich was asked over the weekend at a game at Milwaukee about the importance of a guy like Patty Mills' leadership in the aftermath of Manu's retirement and Kawhi's trade. And Pop used that as a reason to kind of take a dig at Kawhi. Pop said, and I'll quote him here, Kawhi was a great player, but he wasn't a leader or anything. He went on to say Kawhi's talent will always be missed, but that leadership wasn't his deal at that time. Now, Kawhi responded by saying, you know, I guess you kind of forget, you know, what you do on the floor there, something along those lines. But what do you make of Greg Popovich continuing to kind of take these subtle and sometimes not so subtle shots at Kawhi Leonard?
That was strange, man. I have to imagine Pop regrets that to some degree. Just to bring him up, like, it would be one thing if he was asked directly about Kawhi, but to just bring him up in that question was so weird. This is absurd, but, like, I was just home, you know, in Florida for Thanksgiving, whatever. This, like, reminds me of the way, like, my aunts will, like, fight with each other. Just, like, this weird, like, you're using a completely unrelated question to become passive aggressive about something completely unrelated. Like, just super weird. It's a bad look for Pop, frankly. Pop is obviously, I think it's safe to say, I know that you get sensitive about this, I think it's safe to say he's a great coach, great guy. It's just really
why
weird.
Why am I sensitive about that?
Well, you called me out about calling Otto Porter a great player.
No, Greg Popovich is one of the greatest coaches of all time. Otto Porter's rich.
I know. Okay. That's a good way to put it. But yeah, I just thought it was a weird look, man. There was just no reason at all for him to bring him up there. And listen, I understand that the Spurs were put in a real awkward position with the Kawhi stuff, and there's probably more to come out about that relationship. But I remember last year, even when all this was going on, Pop was like, I love the kid. I want what's best for him. And now to go here, it just didn't make any sense. And I kind of liked Kawhi's response. He's like, hey, you know, don't forget who was carrying the team. Like, you might have had Manu and Patty or whatever, but, you know, when it's a playoff game and it's the fourth quarter and overtime against the Grizzlies and you need someone to score however many points in a row, I'm the one getting the ball. So it was just a weird, weird look from Pop. And I'm worried how frustrated he is seeing how well Kawhi is playing in Toronto right now while he's trying to force a team into the playoffs.
Oh, I think he's incredibly frustrated.
It's got to be.
It's got to be, because he knew at the end of last year that it was probably more likely than not that Kawhi Leonard could be on the floor helping them. And while the Spurs were not on Golden State's level, you insert Kawhi Leonard into that mix, even a guy that only played 9 games during the season, you give yourself a puncher's chance. I mean, this was the former finals MVP. You give yourself a puncher's chance to at least advance to a conference finals and then see what you can do. I mean, remember, a year before that, they were in the conference finals. They were up 20 points on Golden State in game one. Then Kawhi injures that ankle, and everything goes downhill from there. So it must be frustrating to see this guy come back and look like he hasn't skipped a beat. And, of course, wonder, and maybe he knows, exactly where Kawhi was physically at the end of last year. I just think it's not a great look. Like you said, the question was not about Kawhi Leonard. It was about Patty Mills and his leadership within this team in the aftermath of some of the defections. The other thing I would say, too, that leads to some frustration is that everybody in San Antonio knew it was most likely Manu Ginobili's final year. They knew Tony Parker's contract situation, and it could have been Tony Parker's last year in San Antonio. To not have the full deck to make one final run with that group, that had to have been frustrating to a lot of people within the Spurs.
Well, it was clearly frustrating to Manu and Tony, right, who were kind of like pretty public about it towards the end of last season, talking about how much they wanted Kawhi playing, the stuff they'd battled through. So, listen, that's going to be a tough one from the Spurs to recover from. Obviously, Pop deserves all the credit in the world. So does that front office. If anyone can kind of navigate this insane scenario, it's them. But I think Pop deep down knows how lucky he was. He's always been open about how lucky he was to get Tim Duncan, to get two stars like that back-to-back and lose Kawhi the way he did. I think it's going to take them a long time to get over that one.
Well, it's also an opportunity missed because clearly Pop still wants to coach. Mm. And the inability now to be able to transition to a Kawhi Leonard team for the next 5-10 years, whatever it is, after transitioning, from Duncan, from David Robinson, really. David Robinson to Duncan to the Parker Ginobili type team to Kawhi. That's got to be frustrating for him there. But far be it from me to criticize a Hall of Fame coach. That's what he is. Lay off some of those Kawhi Leonard shots there. All right, let me finish with this. Last weekend, I got my first-hand look at Trae Young and Luka Doncic. We know these two guys were flipped for each other on draft night. They'll be inextricably linked for their entire career. Rohan, Trae Young has been good, but he struggled from the three. Luka Doncic has been excellent and is the front runner right now for Rookie of the Year. Your thoughts on those two guys? If you had to do the draft over again, would you do anything differently? Would you take Trae Young or Luka Doncic?
So here's the thing. I thought the Suns should have taken, frankly, Doncic number one overall. I was that high on Doncic. I do feel bad for Trae Young, who I really like. We had him over at the SI office one day. He's a great kid. I really, really like him. I kind of hate how they've been inextricably linked. As you mentioned, I think they both have the potential to be really good players. Here's something I'll say about what's going on earlier in their careers. Obviously, those are both likely lottery-bound teams, Atlanta especially, Dallas almost definitely. But
Atlanta's the worst team in the NBA.
Yeah.
Like they're
bad.
They're bad.
But Doncic, I think, is in a little bit more of a position to succeed right now. I mean, not only is he someone who's been playing pro basketball, but he's playing for a veteran coach, playing for an organization that's a little more stable. You can argue the veteran guys around him don't like him very much, but he's playing with a more mature roster. I just think Doncic is in immediately a better position to succeed than Young is. Young is kind of being asked to carry that team, take all the big shots, and that's going to, I think, make his struggles more apparent early in the season. So it's a little bit of a cop-out answer. I know it's a push. I know that, you're one of these debate guys and you want me to take a side, but I just think they both have
one of these debate guys. Did you see me on First Take this morning or something?
I just think they both have the potential to be great players, and I personally don't feel the need to pit them against each other. I think they both can mean a lot to their organizations one day.
Yeah, look, I think it's not one or the other. They both can be great players. I just watching and look, it's completely unfair to compare Trae Young, who played one season at Oklahoma and who was not billed as the next big thing coming into that first season, to Luka Doncic, who was the EuroLeague MVP and was playing for Real Madrid at age 16. So, he's at a completely different level right now. All that being said, I think Doncic has the much higher upside. I mean, he's just, physically, it looks like he's going to be he's bigger anyway, but just for his position, a really big guy. He's already succeeding in the post. He's already succeeding with the pass. He's already succeeding with the three-point shot. I mean, these are skills, I think, that are only going to get better. There was a narrative I sort of heard around draft night that yeah, Luka Doncic is great, but his lack of athleticism creates something of a ceiling for him compared to Trae Young, who may be able to crash through that ceiling, even though he's less of a sure thing than Doncic is. I don't think a lack of athleticism is Luka Doncic's problem. You know, watching him play, he seems plenty athletic to play that position. He's so crafty with the ball and so good off the dribble and just so smart with such a great basketball IQ. I think we're looking at a great player in Dallas. I mean, they got themselves a franchise player with the Mavericks and Doncic. And I'm not sure if Trae Young is going to be a franchise player. I think he's going to be a good player. And Trae Young, you know, the three-point shot is not going all that well, but it's not sexy, but he's great going to the basket. Like, he scores off the dribble well. His floater is already like a veteran's move for him. He is excellent on the inside. He just has to figure out the outside and make all that work.
For sure, and I think that'll obviously come with experience and playing for a better team. I'm with you on Doncic, though. Like, I really, really thought that he should be the number one overall pick. Like, it made no sense to me. You look at where the sport is headed. It's headed for guys like him who can play multiple positions, who can handle the ball, who can shoot. His game is just so multifaceted that it never made sense to me that he fell as far as he did. So I'm with you. I do think he is that capability of being a franchise type guy. I don't think Atlanta will regret it. Like, I think Young has, like you said, maybe not franchise guy, but, you know, good enough to help lift that organization. So I don't think Atlanta will regret it, but you know who I think will regret it is Phoenix, because you take a center number one in 2018. Frankly, that doesn't make sense to me. And I thought Doncic was the best player in that draft.
Yeah. You make a good point about Phoenix. And look, I like DeAndre Ayton, and he looks like a guy that could become one of those modern centers that we're seeing right now that could step out and shoot the three and be athletic. So I think he's got potential, but I think Luka Doncic is a star in the making out there. And one thing you have to remember with Atlanta too, in addition to getting Trae Young, they also got a first round pick out of it in 2019. So that's valuable. The one other thing I would add about Trae Young is, you know, Travis Schlenk, the GM, was locked in on him for a while. You know, people in Atlanta have told me that, you know, Travis was in on Trae Young before Oklahoma started their season, you know, before he kind of took off as a player. So there was a lot of interest and belief in him. And, you know, Travis comes from that Golden State system where they like these high skilled, you know, shooting players like Steph Curry and, you know, Klay Thompson, a whole bunch of guys that are out there now. So Trae Young kind of fits that mold. I would say this too about Trae Young. He's not Steph Curry. Like, he is far more to me Steve Nash. Has Steve Nash potential? He has Steph Curry potential. I know he makes those improbable three-point shots at times, but how he probes the paint and how he kind of weaves in and out, to me, it's much more Steve Nash than it is Steph Curry.
Yeah, that's a good point. I do think people kind of conflate hitting deep threes with being like Steph Curry, and now, like, over the last couple of years, LeBron has hit more deep threes than Steph Curry. What Steph does is his game is based so much on gravity and movement that people don't kind of respect him for that. Obviously, the shooting is incredible, but there's so much else that he does that kind of makes that system go that it would be almost impossible for someone like Trae Young to replicate all those things.
Yeah. All right. I got Scal coming up next. Do you want to get a Celtics dig in before I have him on?
You know, I thought about it. You know, last night I sent you the email and I just wanted to, I was going to make a dig, but I just really wanted to check in with you, make sure you were doing all right. Cause I know you and all those Boston guys, like, I'm pretty sure like North Korean dictators get more harsh coverage than Brad Stevens. So I just wanted to make sure you guys were doing all right. I know you wrote about them this week and that was probably hard for you. Just make sure you guys were doing okay, seeing as how the Celtics, the Gordon Hayward thing is fascinating.
Can I just
to me.
Pause you there for a second?
Please do.
Do you think that North Korean dictators should get, do you think Brad Stevens should get harsher coverage than North Korean dictators? I'm not quite sure I followed that example.
I'm saying that, like, the state-run media in North Korea doesn't say anything about
it. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And that's what's happening in Boston.
Gotcha.
Right now. Yeah.
I went over my head there a little bit.
I apologize. I know I tend to get geopolitical on my NBA podcast. But,
okay,
here's something that I did actually want to ask you about the Celtics, and it's a little bit of reckless speculation. But how convinced are you that Kyrie is re-signing next year?
If there is a five-year full max offer on the table, I am convinced Kyrie is coming back.
Gotcha. I was chatting with someone who I would describe as, like, in NBA circles, when I was in Florida this last week, who seemed to have it on pretty good authority that Kyrie has told people that he really, really wants to play in New York one day. And I think it's so, the situation to me with him is just a little fishy, where he was talking about, yeah, I already considered the Knicks. And it's like, why would you do that if you're not a free agent? So I got my eye on that, especially the way the season's going right now. I'm really curious how it shakes out with him in Boston.
I mean, the Knicks are always, look, I kind of got the ball rolling on that last June when I wrote and said at the time that the Celtics were scared about losing Kyrie Irving to the Knicks because there is a pretty strong home connection. I've always said that, you know, home can be magnetic one way or the other for athletes. You know, a guy like Durant wants nothing to do with playing in Washington, nothing to do with playing in that D.C. area because he just doesn't like the idea of playing close to home. You flip it around, LeBron James loved playing, you know, near Akron, Ohio. I think Kyrie is more the latter in that he, you know, he would love the opportunity, all things being equal, to play in New York at the Garden for the Knicks. All things, though, are not equal. He has a great situation in Boston. He has got a team around him that should be a threat to win a championship for the next 4 or 5 years. He's got a high-level coach, however you want to grade him out. Would you take Brad Stevens or David Fizdale at this point? I mean, let's just be real. He's got a high-level coach that he has there. He's got a high-level GM. He's got stability in that organization. He's the face of that organization. And the cherry on top, he can make the most money. And for a guy that's coming off 3 knee surgeries in the last 2+ years, that's not insignificant. So, nothing is done by any stretch. And, you know, we'll have to see if Boston will come out with that 5-year full max offer. But if they do, I think Kyrie steps in and signs it.
All right, I'm with you on that. I do think if Boston gives him that full max, it's a done deal. But I don't think that's as tied up as he's made it out to seem so far this year.
Oh, Boston's not acting like it either. I mean, you ask, and I've read some of the public comments, and you know they haven't said like it's great to have Kyrie committed for the next 7-8 years. The way they put it is like it's great that Kyrie believes in us or is showing that kind of faith in us. So they're not, look, they're on board with being cautious about this as well. I just think that money's going to talk, the situation's going to talk, and Kyrie will be in Boston for the long term. I'll have to log this podcast, so when he doesn't, I'll have egg right on my face. Rohan, great to talk to you here, man. Looking forward to doing this more with you as the season goes on.
Yeah, man, absolutely. I'm hoping to get an invite to the home studio one of these days. So
The home studio, probably off limits.
Okay.
Probably off limits. Enough. The New York studio, we can share. The home studio, probably off limits. All right. When we come back, my conversation with Brian Scalabrine. All right, joining me now on the podcast, talk a little bit about the Boston Celtics. Brian Scalabrine, you can listen to him on Sirius XM NBA Radio. See him on NBC Sports Boston. What's up, Scal?
What's your new podcast called now?
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
Oh, nice. Not just you go all NBA.
Yes.
You get special guests, but I dominate of all special guests.
Yes.
I am the guest of all guests.
When there is the opportunity to get you, as we sit here in Dallas recording this podcast, I jump at the opportunity. Especially when, man, Celtics are a weird team.
Oh, it's so weird, man. I'm telling you, as an analyst, all the guys who I think like the naysayer, not naysayers, but like the average basketball fan was telling me all summer, it's going to be tough, man. We got too many players. We got this, too many guys. We got too many guards. And I was like, have you watched the NBA lately? You're like, we're fine. You know, like in the NBA, you want to have, you know, defensive versatility. You want to have multiple guys that can play multiple positions. That's exactly what we have. Then you add the fact that you have Brad Stevens, and I think that's like perfect, right up his alley. And then the season starts, and all those fans are right. I'm supposed to be like some know-it-all analyst, and I was dead wrong.
So did you think, were you of the belief that this was like, I think the over-under was like 65.5, that this was the favorite to come out of the Eastern Conference? Did you buy that coming into the season?
I thought Toronto would be good just because of Kawhi. And I'm, you know, like, I didn't overreact to Kawhi Leonard sitting out the year because I just, like, he was 3 years ago or was that 2 seasons ago? He's one of my favorite players in the NBA. So now he goes to Toronto. And I think they upgraded. I didn't know he was going to be this good. But I thought it would be a dogfight between us and Toronto. I didn't like cross off Toronto because I just thought they lost to LeBron. And that was like a mental hurdle. But I did think that we would win 60 games for sure.
So, open-ended question. What's the biggest thing that's gone wrong with this team?
Yeah, that's a good question. And Just first off, it's consistency. Like, even last night, and I don't know if this is dated or not, but they played Atlanta, and they had 45 points in the first quarter and 4 field goals in the second quarter. Like, how does that happen? And I think there's a little complacency, which is odd, because they don't seem like a complacent type of group. If you think about what you saw last year and next man up, injuries and all that stuff, they're a little complacent. And I think offensively, guys improved in certain areas that might not transition into winning basketball for now. You know, I get it. Like, you go through the playoffs and it's different. You have to be able to – shot clock runs down, really good defensive possession. You're going to get the ball with 5 seconds on the clock, and you're going to have to do something with the ball. And that might be, you know, step-back jumper, a tough shot, and you're going to have to make those. But it felt like they're taking those shots 19 seconds on the clock as opposed to – move the ball crisp, cut hard, drive to the basket, and then find open shooters. And then if a defense does play for 20 seconds and now you have 4 on the clock, go ahead and do your thing and be creative. And this is what I've always said, the difference between like an all-star and a Hall of Famer is 2 possessions a game. That Hall of Famer makes that shot with 2 seconds on the shot clock where the all-star might miss and the average player can't get a shot off. And I think – the Celtics right now, I think their offense is bogged down with, it's my turn to shoot. What should I do? I got to figure out a way to get me a shot versus just going out there and playing.
One of the issues I had with this team, and I want to get your take on it, was the start of the season. And starting lineups don't mean everything, but I didn't love the idea of kind of putting all 5 of those guys into the starting lineup. I felt like, you know, it's not the death lineup that Golden State used, but it could be utilized in that way in short bursts here or there. You don't sacrifice anything putting Aaron Baines in the starting lineup because he's one of, not the best defensive center in all of basketball. It just felt to me like Brad Stevens was kind of trying to placate some of the bigger egos that have gotten there. I mean, Tatum and Brown don't want to be bench guys. Al Horford's certainly not a bench guy. Hayward and Irving are starters. It just felt like it wasn't the best basketball lineup, but it was the lineup that wouldn't get anybody in a bad mood going into the season. What do you think of that?
I always thought that Baines should have started just because – but listen, the league changes quickly, and my perspective of the NBA is – I'm a hard screen and roll guy. And just because from being out there and having to defend a guy like Baines coming down the middle, a guy like Kyrie driving, and like a range shooting 4 or 3 or 2 on the weak side – I think it's the hardest thing you have to guard. And when the season started out and they didn't start Baines, and you got Al Horford picking and popping, which is fine, like especially late in the game, picking and popping is great because teams don't want to overreact. They're afraid of the shot. You're going to get a wide open shot or Kyrie's going to turn the corner. But I think you have to have a rim presence. And so far, the Celtics have not had a paint or restricted area presence. And I thought Baines would solve that problem. And I think Brad's going to continue to stick with it going long term. But when you talk about placate, maybe at the end of the day, it was to all get Gordon Hayward on, you know, like get him going, you know, figure out the best way for him to get up to speed. Because I do think this, no matter what happened last year, that team wasn't going to beat Golden State. So I think you need what you had last year in addition to a great Kyrie, in addition to not Gordon Hayward of 2 years ago. I'm not asking for that, but playmaking Gordon Hayward. And the only way you're ever going to get to that is to have those guys hit their stride. But ultimately, I like the sacrifice that Gordon Hayward's making coming off the bench. I don't know if Brad went to him or he came to Brad, but Baines needs to be in the starting lineup. And that's my opinion. It's been that way last year when the season started and they didn't start Baines. This year when the season started and they didn't start Baines, and now that they're starting Baines, I just believe that he makes the offense run a lot better.
As someone that's played on great teams, coached some good teams, now broadcasting for some good teams, is it possible to have too much talent on a roster?
No. But I will say this, Chris. From all my years, this thing, I was in the league 11 years, and 8 of those years I felt like we could have made it to the NBA Finals and won a few championships, right? You know, this Nets team, like we made it to the finals against the Lakers, but we weren't a contender that year. But so 8 out of the 11. And the one thing that was pretty consistent about the teams that we played against that were great and our teams, it was like this huge voice, leadership, guy who like sets the tone every single day. Jason Kidd, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, those type. And in Chicago is unique. We had Joakim Noah, who was like getting his mouthpiece kind of started, and all the craziness that goes along with him. But we also had a really vocal coach in Tibbs. And it's like, it seems there was always like a big presence. I don't see that presence on this team. I see the talent on this team, no question. And I'm not saying this is only my perspective. Then I started looking back on the teams who's ever won. You just start naming them. They always had like a huge personality presence. And our top four guys are relatively quiet. Like Kyrie, Gordon, Al, and Jason Tatum, right? Those guys are like relatively quiet. The two vocal guys are Marcus and Marcus. And those guys are coming off the bench. So I do think they have talent, and it's not, I'd rather have more talent than not. But I do think it's really unique that they're this good without having that, like, I don't want to say like alpha dog, but it kind of feels like I don't know who that guy is.
To take a micro look at some of the things, is Gordon Hayward where he should be at this point?
Yeah, for sure.
No issues so. with he's played.
Sort yeah,
of, this I is think, what you should expect.
Yeah, I don't think. I was thinking more like February or March. You know what he's becoming really good of late is a great off ball cutter, and he's still not finishing great, but like he's moving. He passes and cuts with. I'm not going to say the same pace because I wasn't there. Like I'm not seeing him every day in Utah, but it looks like he's cutting with the same pace. And then when he goes to the basket, that's like the hugest. Discrepancy before what he used to be in now. But and I think that will come. I mean, I think they'll get to a point where he turns the corner and elevates. And I think he's taking the steps, just like baby steps forward. And listen, the guy signed for $29 million. He gets hurt 5 minutes into the season. He's also trying to live up to the contract, right? In his mind, like a lot of people don't understand that. They think, oh, it's great. You get $120 million. But a lot of players have pride, and they want to live up to their deal. They don't want to be the guy that everyone's talking about. Like, I can't believe we paid him all that money. Like, Gordon Hayward wants to live up to the contract. So, obviously, the first year he didn't because he got hurt, and it's not his fault. And now the second year, he's, like, feeling like, I came here to make a difference, and I haven't yet. So, I think there's been some additional pressure on him. But with the rapid fire schedule, eventually that stuff goes away. You just keep playing and playing and playing, and you get more reps. But I think Gordon, especially late, he's been shooting the ball better. I just want to see him turn the corner and not dunk on somebody, but dunk it before a guy comes to block it, like quick dunk on a guy.
Obviously, the injury issue with Hayward is the biggest part of his coming back and rounding back into form. But I'm curious, as a player, is there anything to the idea that Gordon Hayward signed on to be on a team with Isaiah Thomas? A month later, he was on a team with Kyrie Irving. He comes back this year, and he's on a completely different team. He's basically on three versions of the Celtics in the year plus he has been with his team. Is there anything to that maybe screwing with the guy mentally?
I don't know. I've never even thought about that. I kind of link him with Brad, and I do link him with wanting to be in a bigger market. Like, we're on TV a lot more than Utah was on TV, even though Utah has a great team. It's just the way it is when you're the Boston Celtics, right? Everywhere you go and the nationally televised games and stuff like that. I think he wanted like a bigger platform, but I'm not sure that he doesn't have like a strong enough personality to care about that kind of stuff. He kind of has like, oh, well, whatever it is, I'll just do it, and that's kind of his MO. But I've never thought about like him making an excuse because of that. Mm.
Yeah, it just seemed like it was different. He's on a different version of the team that he originally signed up for. The last couple of weeks, people have shoved an old tweet of mine down my throat. When the Celtics were playing like peak basketball last year, I put some, and this might have been.
Oh, I know this tweet.
This is the one where I said Brad Stevens. I said, if you could take Brad Stevens or any player in the NBA, if you're an expansion team, who would you take? It's just a poll. I put a poll up there on Twitter for that.
Wait, expansion team being that
if you're the Las Vegas whatevers and you can have your pick of any player in the NBA.
You could pick Anthony Davis or Brad Stevens.
Yes.
You said what?
I didn't say anything. I just put it up there and just see what the reaction would be. And 34% of the respondents, there was like 5,000 respondents, 34% of the respondents said Brad Stevens. So in the aftermath of all this, people have been like digging up that tweet, firing it back at me. They're like, you still think this is a good poll, Mannix? But let me ask you, and this all leads to this question. How do you think Brad Stevens has handled this? Because this is his first real adversity. I mean, he's been the underdog coach at every step of the way.
I tried to ask him that yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't, it's like, that's a hard question to ask a guy in a pregame interview. But I did try to ask him that, the hunter. I did a terrible job of asking that question. But I will say this, when it comes to this group right here, or even in the past, you know, you've been in the huddles, I've been in the huddles. The one thing about Brad, he doesn't beg players to play. He tells them what to do, and it's on them from there. So I just find that really interesting with a group like this who's so good. He's not going to beg Jaylen Brown to take the ball harder to the basket or Jason Tatum to stop shooting shots. I think he's just going to take them out and just say, like, all right, if you're not going to do what I asked you to do, it's okay. It's your choice, but I have someone else I can go with. So I don't know how he's handling this so far, but it might be. It's funny. Everyone always says, like, oh, well, Phil Jackson had Shaq, Kobe, Jordan, and Pippen. Sometimes those can be the most challenging years as a coach. You know, like, extracting everything out of a talented guy, even though expectations are high, it could be a different type of challenge versus, I remember just last year, a good example was, like, he maximized Shane Larkin to the most of his ability. Used him at a perfect moment, got him going to his right hand. He run plays for game-winning plays for Shane Larkin to get downhill. And he's like, he's one of these guys. But what happens when your players are talented? They can do everything where, you know, like, their strengths and weaknesses are a lot closer than, you know, like a player like me who can make corner threes, but I can't do anything else, right? Like, he's so good at extracting talent out of guys who have weaknesses and covering up those weaknesses that I don't know his strategy so far of coaching these guys. But I do know from being in the huddles, it's all about telling them what he wants them to do and not begging them.
You can make a list of guys who've had their average to above average talents maximized. Jay Crowder is on that list. Isaiah Thomas certainly on that list. Sure. The whole laundry list.
Evan Turner. You can't even go back. Avery Bradley. There's a lot of guys.
Back in your day, Jason Kidd got guys paid. I think Brad Stevens has started to get some guys paid.
Yeah.
You know, with the way he's helped these guys out. The young guys, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. Any concern for either one of them? Jaylen struggled. No, I mean, for this year, about getting getting kind of into the flow with this team. Long term, they're talented guys. Yeah. But
I mean, I'm not like ducking the question, Chris, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because it's so early in the season. I don't know. I feel like Tatum is going to be fine. And another what's interesting is, like, Brad has had a ton of injuries in the past, and now when he kind of needs an injury, he doesn't have any, right? And usually, like,
injury would be good for this team,
right? Like, in a weird way, like, even Al Horford missed the Atlanta game, and like everyone like played appropriate minutes, right? So
yeah, Baines had 16 points.
Yeah, Ogilvy got to play one of his best games of the year. So.
You have midseason vacations. Be like, guys, you can just take 5 games.
Yeah, like in baseball, don't they give days off in baseball? That'd be great.
Yeah, you give pitchers.
You're just like, all right, you can take a day off.
Take this trip off. You're gonna just.
Yeah. So I don't know. I do know that each player on this team has something that they're really good at, and if they focus on that, then I think that they'll be fine. Jason Tatum of late has been going harder to the basket. Like, how do you stop a guy with that type of athleticism when he's going to the basket? He's got a sick handle, right? And then Jaylen Brown's the same thing. And Brad drew up a few plays for him getting downhill the other day. So I don't know. I don't know if these are going to be long-term things. Because, once again, I've never been in that perspective, in that situation when I am like some crazy talented player who had a great year last year and now my minutes are going away. I just like I don't even know what that's like. From my whole thing was just like, go out there. Get your opportunity, play the best you can in your chance. And, you know, some nights it's going to be good, and some nights you're going to be average. But I can see a lot of these guys like, man, last year when I got an opportunity, I played better. I shot 10% better from three. I was better at the basket. And I think that stuff can, like, really weigh on a guy. The cream always rises to the top in the NBA. When that happens, I don't know. If it does happen. So it's going to be really interesting. I just – going back to the original question, I am so surprised that this has not worked seamlessly based off of the players and Brad Stevens. I've been shocked so far this season.
It feels like the preseason might have been foreboding some of this. Last year in the preseason, the optimism coming out of that training camp was really high. You know, Irving and Hayward were practically giddy about some of the stuff they were running together, that two-man game stuff. You know, obviously Hayward back with Brad. You didn't have that in this preseason. Now, people said it was just the preseason, but the preseason has bled into the regular season. Yeah. A lot of that same stuff you saw in the preseason is happening right now. Let me ask you just lastly, do you expect this thing to turn around? Do you expect it to hit December, January, February, and all of a sudden this team's going to go on some kind of run?
I feel like I lie a lot in the business, and I always have an answer. But I'm like, I truly do not know. Mm. And the other day after a Knick game, I did an hour post-game show, and I don't really know the answer. I've never seen anything.
I watched you at the top of that post-game.
I was like, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to say. I don't know if they're going to turn it around, or I don't know if it bothers them or not.
It's hard to explain the open shots in that Knick game. Like, they were wide open from three in
that
Knick game.
That's not just a Knick game, Chris. Here's a stat. Now, I'm not a big stat guy, but here's a stat. I think they get the third most wide open shots in the NBA, and they shoot the 29th percentage of those wide open shots. So, like, garbage teams. Like, just think, like, the Phoenix Suns shoot better than us in wide open shots. Like, how is that possible? Like, how does the Atlanta Hawks have a higher shooting percentage in wide open situations than the Boston Celtics? Like, that's unexplainable. There's no way that anybody could ever foresee that. Yet, we're moving the ball and getting the third most wide open shots in the NBA.
Crazy, man. Scal, always appreciate it.
So what is it called again?
It's the Crossover NBA Podcast, part of the Sports Illustrated Podcast Network. It's, you know,
I'm glad you're back on the road with us, man.
I'm back, man. It's going to be, Abby is going to be out for a couple months.
Yeah, this is going to be good.
We had a couple of chances to banter in Atlanta. Hopefully, we have a few more moving forward. I did like Kyle Draper, you know, like, Trae Young needs more weapons. Like,
that was
okay,
good.
All right. No, the worst team in the NBA needs more weapons.
How about Kyle saying, oh, I'm just grinding out. And I'm like, yeah, we're really grinding right here.
Sorry, you get on your private jet later.
We're sitting here courtside talking about the Boston Celtic game. And then we're going to go jump on a private jet and come to the Ritz-Carlton in Dallas. Shut up, man.
It's a hard knock life for Kyle Drip, I got to tell you.
You got to check yourself, Kyle.
Scal, appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining me.
See ya.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Rohan Nadkarni and Brian Scalabrine for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
Of the work week is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.